Check, check. 1, 2, 1, 2. What's up, everybody? This is Craddy with the Live and Direct show. This episode, I talked to Daddy Kev of Alpha Pup Records out of Los Angeles. Alpha Pup has been around for a long time. He's been a pioneer of the beat scene, of a lot of the underground hip-hop scene out here. And Daddy Kev is really a tastemaker, kind of a pioneer. He is definitely one of the main people responsible for the explosion of the beat scene out here in Los Angeles. Not only does he run Alpha Pup Records, but he runs Low End Theory, the night that has gotten acclaim all around the world, really, for being a pioneer in the forefront of electronic music and the beat scene. Kev is a very wise person. He's been in the scene a long time, and he gives it to you straight. It's one of my favorite things about him. So enjoy this interview. This is Daddy Kev from Alpha Pup Records and Low End Theory on Live and Direct. All right.
All right.
Cool. What's up, Kev?
What up, Craddy?
Hey, this is Craddy with the Live and Direct show. I'm talking to Daddy Kev of Alpha Pup Records, Low End Theory, general tastemaker, beatmaker, producer, executive.
Zookeeper.
Zookeeper. Totally, totally. Well, I want the line, I always think of this with you, but I never talked to you about this, that I think the Grouch said it, which he was like, Daddy Kev, daddy to us all, or something. I think he says that on one of his records, and I always realize, like, you do have this father figure position in the whole scene. Like, I would say there's a huge number of young men who wouldn't have careers if it wasn't for you kind of mentoring them through the process. That's a sort of, and your natural demeanor is sort of a, you like, you bring people in, you help them out, you know.
I mean, that's definitely the idea. I mean, I think with...
Is that where Daddy Kev came from?
I mean, well, strangely enough, I mean, I got, the origin of that name was more, I mean, it's almost embarrassing. It was from like high school when there was that big song by Criss Cross, Jump.
Yeah, that? Yeah,
Criss Cross,
sure.
And then the two guys in the group was like, Daddy Mac and Mac Daddy.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So.
This is awesome, dude.
This is actually what it was. Like when that, you know, and they had all those raps in the song of, you know, Miggity Mac Daddy. And
Right. Miggity Mac.
Right. Yeah. So it just became like a nickname. You know what I mean? I honestly always thought I was going to come up with something better.
Yeah.
You know, like at that point, I wasn't exactly thinking I was going to have a career in music, but I was definitely thinking like, all right, if I'm going to keep DJing,
because
I was already DJing at that point, that I would, you know, come up with something more like, you know, like.
When was this? Was this in college?
This is in high school.
In high school. Yeah. Out here in Cali.
In California, Los Angeles, yeah.
Yeah. And then, so I was reading a bunch of interviews with you, and everyone goes back to like the beginning of Low End Theory, but it seems like I know you, and we were friends. We have all these friends in common. That USC was like really all these people at the same place at the same time. Like,
yeah, I mean, that was, I mean, I think the era when I was doing Concrete Jungle.
Okay, you were already doing Concrete Jungle when you were at USC.
Well, I went to UCSD. UCSD. But you're talking about, like, you know, like we're, you know, Daedalus and...
Right, know, okay, and, I thought you were part of that scene,
well,
too.
Well, I mean, I was to a certain degree because, number one, that's when they were... Mark McNeil, who started Dub Lab, was doing... They were all kind of gravitating around the radio station down there, which used to actually broadcast, which, strangely enough, and I mean, this blew my mind when it happened, this was the USC official station, as it turned out, for, like, the preceding 25 years had actually been a pirate broadcast.
Oh, really?
They never had like a real FCC license, yet they were broadcasting on an FM frequency, right?
Because it was just some big college that everyone just assumed.
Yeah, I guess. Somehow that slipped through the cracks. Mm. So when the bust happened, that's what started Dub Lab. But it was interesting at that same time, you know, Concrete was going, or not Concrete wasn't going yet, but what was happening was... basically, me and Hive, our Weed Connect was down at USC.
Right.
So we started going to this place called the Dollhouse to buy weed, and that's where we kind of like. And then the next thing you know, the Dollhouse girls are like, "All right, we're throwing a party down here. You guys should DJ.
Yeah.
So me and Hive are DJing these.
You guys are playing hip hop at that point?
Drum and bass. And hip hop stuff.
Yeah.
And
but this it was is just, like 90.
This is 97.
Okay.
You know, 98-ish.
Yeah.
Going into 99.
Right.
But we DJed a bunch of parties down there, and that's when, you know, Ed.
Totally.
His nickname used to be Raver Ed.
Right.
So this is during the Raver Ed, you know, era. And,
yeah, totally.
You know, and he was, you know, tripping out on our what sets we were doing.
Yeah.
I think even Ed was DJing at some of that stuff. Alfred was DJing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I remember Ed telling me about getting, I think it was Will telling me or Daedalus about Ed getting kicked off the decks, actually, because he's playing all this weird hip hop shit and people are like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely
like house parties and frat parties and shit like that.
Yeah, I mean, and we were doing, and it was cool though. It was a really cool scene, and you know, just really kind of formed, just what became, you know, just the where we sowed the seeds of kind of things to come. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
And but you know, it was definitely, you know, at that point. I think for me, really, you know, when concrete started cracking, that was like my, insofar as clubs are concerned,
yeah.
You know, when it really, I started to really see the return on investment, you know.
And that was like, that's where you kind of learned, that was your first try at promoting and throwing a night and everything. So, end theory, you were like, okay, now I kind of know what I'm doing a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, up until Concrete, I had done a series of just one-off shows when I went to college at UC San Diego.
Where was Jungle in LA?
That was at Spaceland.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, or whatever, the satellite right. Now.
Yeah.
Spaceland at the time. And that was like the golden age of Spaceland.
Right.
Know? That's when like Beck was performing there right. On the other nights. And
you know, right, right.
All kind of great stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, we wore that place out. I mean, we did it for 2.5 years or something.
It was a weekly.
Yeah, yeah. And it just kind of, you know, we just kind of reached the end of it, dude. It's just we drove them to the, yeah, I mean, a lot of.
Well, drum and bass changed at that point, right, too. I think drum and bass had like a very hot, short life in the States. Because I was into it about the same time you were, and it was... I was loving it, and it felt like I had just all the potential in the world, and then it sort of dipped into this heavy, grindy, just the most aggressive one.
Yeah, it's like heavy metal stuff.
Yeah, and then it became a bunch of guys standing there, and all the girls left, and that's when you know the ship's going down, yeah. You know?
I mean, you know, it's interesting. I mean, there's still, you know, one thing I realized about all these, you know, genres of music, movements of music, is that they never... is that there's people that always hold on to it, right? So even though, you know, drum and bass is, you know, heyday was, you know, arguably years ago,
mm-hmm.
there's still, you know, plenty of dudes, you know, pushing that sound and, you know, and pushing it, trying to push it forward.
I think drum and bass in a lot of ways is now almost on the back up. Like, it's coming back around as...
Yeah, just, I mean, I think it's like there's a certain... There was a time when it just... was, I mean, I'll tell you, just from playing it at Low End,
yeah.
You know, like,
there was a drum and bass act there a couple weeks ago when I was there.
Yeah, well, we had Lee Bannon not that long ago,
uh-huh.
and we've been, I mean, and we had Alex Perez.
Yeah, like that's who it was.
When you were
yeah.
there, and, but what's interesting, though, is that just a few years, maybe just 3 years ago, I would play drum and bass at the club, and it would be like allergic reaction, you know, people would just
leave the room.
Like, immediate. Just like, what if anyone was moving, they just stop.
It's over. Yeah. Yeah.
Then they're like,
what?
Looking at their friends.
Right.
Looking at their phone. Like,
right.
you know, but now what's interesting is in the last at least 12 months, because I never stopped playing drum and bass. I played, I try to play at least one cut a night down
mm-hmm.
there. But
yeah.
It's definitely the reaction has changed quite a bit. Definitely people are way more open to it right now than they were 3 years ago.
Yeah,
that's for certain. You know,
was drum and bass your introduction to DJing, or was hip hop your introduction to DJing?
Hip hop. I mean,
okay.
my introduction to DJing was actually, I mean, in junior high. You know, like many years ago, with strangely enough, Frank. You know, Big Frank.
Uh-huh.
You know, we basically, me, him, my brother, and this dude from our neighborhood, Ron. We kind of started like a DJ crew.
Oh, how did you find out about DJing? What was the first DJ you saw that was, you were like, oh, this is a DJ?
probably at my junior high school dances.
Oh, really?
Just because in the South Bay, there was like a real, how shall I put it? Just the mobile DJ thing was like a big deal.
Right, right, right.
All these crews, you know.
So they had like sound systems and stuff. Yeah. So it was almost like Jamaica.
In a way, yeah. But mainly it was totally like Filipino dominated, you know.
Right.
Like,
totally.
One of the main guys in LA was this dude who's still around, Icy Ice from Beat Junkies. And he had this thing called Legend Entertainment. And that was in the neighborhood I grew up. That was, he was like one of the main, you know, dudes, you know. So that was a real interesting thing. And then we had another neighbor, this dude, Rodney. By the time I got to high school, and basically what I got to do my senior year was basically be this dude's roadie. You know, for all these, and he had this.
And he was a mobile DJ guy.
He was a mobile DJ. This guy Rodney Martin, and he had basically not a contract, but a really good relationship with all these LAUSD high schools.
Mm-hmm.
So we would, you know, he would DJ like all the, not all of them, but a good amount of, you know, homecomings, winter formals, proms,
right,
for all these big LA.
And
high schools.
Is with records and turntables and the whole coffin setup.
Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we would. I was basically, you know, we would, every Friday and Saturday night, I want to say my senior year, I'd go to Rodney's after school, like 6 to 7 o'clock. Basically, me and one other dude, this dude, Anajay, we would load up his entire van, like do all the lifting. It was breaking our backs, too, you know.
Totally.
Get to the dance. We'd set everything up, right? And basically do everything except he would DJ during the prime time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was making bank back then, at least to us, you know, which would be like $400 or $500 for these gigs.
Right.
And we got $20 each, you know, at the end of each night, which, dude, that was like the best money ever at that point. Because we got to open up, you know.
Right.
He let us DJ, you know, like.
So you brought all your records and got to play.
Oh, yeah. And he let us play his records because he was in all these record pools. And
it's so interesting how that was such a thing. Like, there's nothing. Like, having a physical record was the only way you had a song.
Right.
And I feel like that dimension of the music industry changing is, like, it's, the impact is greater than people give it credit for. It's, like, not having a physical thing, just a file that gets just passed around that can be replicated equally.
Innumerable. It's never been more disposable.
Right. And that's, it just changes it where it was, like, if you had a record, that might have been the only record. Or the one of few, the only way to hear that song was to play that thing. And now it's, you know, I mean, for better or for worse, it's just the change. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just, you know, from a creator point of view or an artist point of view, you know, it's just, you know, we don't get to make up the rules, you know, of how art's consumed, you know, and, you know, I think, in a way, you know, how maybe, you know, classical, you know, painters reacted to when, you know, their paintings began to be, you know, reproduced or photographed.
Right, right.
And the advent of that, of how that really changes, you know, what the intended, you know, perceptual, you know, part is supposed to be like and how they intended it to be seen. I mean, I think there's a certain part of it where you just got to be like, hey, well, hey, you know, if it's great art, it's gonna resonate.
Yeah, right. Whatever format or however the times change.
Exactly, you know, and I don't know. I and of course, you know, hey, I mean, we, you know, I have a record label and, we market records, so we try to be acutely aware of all this stuff and not trivialize it because it all matters, you know, and we're trying to, like, basically monetize music for artists. I mean, that's really the point of that company's, you know, existence. And, you know, it's definitely... you know, I'd be lying if I didn't say I'm not troubled, you know, by, you know, how things are going, except for the fact that it just means that you really have to be operating at a certain scale to be able to make a living from records.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And most people I know, even some of the biggest artists I know, aren't able to do it off records.
Right.
You know, and I mean...
It's surprising sometimes. Yeah. You know, you meet these... like, you know, big artists that are bigger in your mind and you realize, like, where their money is coming from is not what you thought. You know, you think they're making tons of money on this and that.
Yeah, or you wonder why Tom Petty's still touring and stuff like that, right? I mean,
right.
You know, this hustle, you know, it doesn't ever end, you know what I mean? And especially if what you're doing is on the road.
Right.
You know?
Did you hear what Tom Petty said about like Insomniac and EDM? Did you catch that quote from a while back?
Yeah, I did.
He was just like, who would watch someone up? He was like, it's a drug culture. And then, you know, who's watched someone play records? Like, you know, that's dumb. And I thought it was whatever. I mean, I don't expect him to get it. And then Pasquale like wrote a response.
Yeah.
And he was like, you know, we welcome Tom Petty to come experience EDC. And, you know, it was a nice response. And, but I just thought it was funny, like this, like him sort of poo-pooing DJing was sort of like, yeah, he's just almost like waving at the ship as it goes away or something. Like,
That's an old man yelling, get off my lawn.
Exactly. You know, that's what I mean. Exactly.
It's just, you know.
It kind of makes sense that he doesn't get it or like it.
Yeah,
you know, he shouldn't.
Well, you know what's funny, though? I mean, at the same time, I mean, on the surface, how can you blame him, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, Tom Petty walking into, you know, looking at these dudes behind a pair of CDJs and just kind of whapping their hands around. I mean,
right.
I mean, it's honestly, from an artistic point of view, not very impressive.
I know.
You know what I mean? I mean, his impression on DJ culture might be different if, you know, maybe he experienced something a little more... you know, the more musical, I guess.
Well, yeah. Do you think that DJ culture, like when the whole thing blew up, I feel like DJ culture, I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like when Skrillex, I mean, the real blow up, not, and all that happened. But then it's made it all of a sudden it mainstream DJ culture into a thing. Like I saw this article, like celebrities are DJing, and it had like, Elijah Wood and Lindsay Lohan DJing. They were like, it's easy if these people can do it. And it was just like, oh, DJing is now like DJing culture. It's something people want to do because it's cool, that it's not about like for a lot of people.
Right. For a lot of people, it's just about money.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, oh, I can, you know, it's supplanted the pop star.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
You know,
it's like, I'm going to make it big as a DJ. Whereas before it was like, I never got, or I'm sure you'd never gotten a DJ and think I was going to be like any big or make money, that much money off of it. There was no one to look up to and say, oh, well that, you know, I'll be like Avicii or, there was like Tiesto, you know, like he was always there, but it wasn't like, I never thought I was going to make it to that point, or I mean, it was even in the cards or anything.
I mean, no one was doing it like that. I mean,
right.
It was really just like, you know, all right, can I make a living at this? Can I make more money from music than I would working
in like a
kitchen, kind of job I could get, you know what I mean, at the time.
And yeah, exactly.
It's just a very, you know, I mean, also too, I mean, things really changed with social media, right? And how that became the main way that people market music. You know what I mean? And for most musicians, how they connect with their audience these days, which is ironic considering we're, you know, really music is supposed to be we're not trying to do it in 140 characters or less, you know?
Right.
But also too, you know, back in the day, you know, before social media, you know, when people, when you had the impression that you were trying to put forth in your image, you didn't do it, you know, on Instagram or on Twitter, you did it in person.
Right.
You know what I mean? You did it, you know, in club settings or in, you know, large event settings. And
yeah,
that's how people's reputations were formed, by how you really, you know, represented yourself in person versus how, you know, people represent themselves online.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think there's this whole... like you said, like the way you are in person, when that's the only way people get to experience you, then it becomes a pretty honest telling of who you are, because people can read other people and they can just kind of see what kind of person and people interact with you. But like when it comes to online and Instagram and all this stuff, it's like it creates this, there's no mystery anymore. I feel like it's all about like everyone wants that like keyhole view into this life. And which is fine, but it also takes away from, like, it pulls back the curtain. I remember when I was in high school and I would listen to Led Zeppelin and I would think about Led Zeppelin, there was no way to contact Led Zeppelin. There was no Twitter for Led Zeppelin or anything for Led Zeppelin. So I just sat there and thought about
what was Led Zeppelin doing and what were they thinking and where were they going? What was going on in this moment? It was just my imagination, but there was a power in that.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas now, if I want to know what Lil Wayne's doing, like, I'll get on Twitter and he'll tell me.
Right.
You know?
And right. And if he doesn't get back at you, you might even be pissed.
Yeah. People write angry messages right. because you didn't get back at them on Twitter or refollow them for whatever reason.
Right.
I don't understand the refollow. Like, I don't know why, you know, it's great. Like, high five. We don't need to, like, hang out for the rest of eternity on a Twitter.
Exactly. I mean, but it's just, it just shows, again, what the modern expectation is.
Right.
Right? That your favorite artist is at your beck and call. You know
right.
what I mean? That you can get their attention, that you can, I don't know, it's definitely made for an interesting, you know, set of, you know, exchange of ideas between, you know, artists and fans. And
but I then as a fan, I've tweeted to people and been stoked when they hit me back. I'm like, oh, awesome. Like Bahamadia, I hit up and she hit me back. And I was like, sweet, this is amazing.
Totally. You know? It really can, you know, make one's day. I mean, you know, again, I'm a huge, you know, I think both you and I, you know, are still huge fans of music. You know what I mean? So it's just like,
exactly.
When you get hit back by somebody, you're like, whoa, you know, like,
yeah, it's totally. Like,
you know, it's still a trip, but I don't know. It's just kind of a weird, you know, that's one thing that in the new era, you know, there's some things about the modern era that are definitely better than before. But
mm-hmm.
I think that part of it sometimes is just a little bit like, oh, man, you know, I don't know. Like, you know, I think so much of it too, I mean, it depends how people use social media too, you know, but it can just be so contrived sometimes.
Yeah.
And even, you know, when I, you know, I'll look at, you know, my own Instagram,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's just kind of like a, I don't know, it's just such a controlled veil.
Yeah.
That, I don't know. It's just sometimes, I mean, I don't know. On the whole, you know, that kind of thing, it's just kind of.
Do you feel like it's difficult to separate, like, your life as just a person and then your professional Daddy Kev persona, if you want to call it that or whatever? I mean, you're Daddy Kev everywhere, but.
It is. I mean, to a certain
degree,
yeah.
You know, like, what part of yourself are you going to show the world and say, this is who Daddy Kev is as far as you guys are concerned, you know, who are fans of my music and things like that?
Right. I mean, well, it also begs the question of just about the use of social media and how am I doing, you know, doing it personally or not?
Right.
You know what I mean? And the funny part is just that, I don't know, like, as now that I have two young kids, you know,
yeah,
I've
right.
definitely gotten a lot more careful about, you know, the kind of imagery I'll share of my kids, just because I've had, there's an incident that had happened, just a weird, you know, I don't think I interpreted it wrong, but it mm-hmm. was just, you know, sometimes people, you know, when they see pictures of your kids, they know your kids' names, and that'll catch me off guard sometimes.
Yeah.
If it's someone I don't know personally.
Right, right.
You know, ask me, oh, you know, how's your daughter, you know, and how's your daughter and your son, or
uh-huh.
and it's like,
uh-huh.
it'll catch me off guard sometimes because the person saying it to me is someone I've never met before.
Yeah, right.
There's not even like an introduction, like, hey, I'm John.
Yeah, you're just like,
that's the first thing they say, you know?
Some people don't have that situational awareness.
Yeah.
You're super keen on that. You're always clocking the room, but a lot of people are just fucking rolling on through and you're just like, why would you say that first thing?
Right, or just even other stuff that's just not appropriate, you know what I mean, about, and that just has made me think, you know, more cautious about that kind of stuff, or pictures I'll post of my wife, or, you know, stuff like that, where I just, you know, I don't want to, you know, it's just kind of, it's a little unnerving.
Yeah, you know? Gave me some of the best advice when it came to social media. You said never post anything negative. Which I thought was really good advice because there's times where you're really worked up and you really want to, like, vent. And social media is not the right place for that kind of stuff. But obviously, a lot of people break that rule all the time.
Yeah.
And it's amusing and whatever, but I don't want to be that guy, you know? And I thought that was really good advice because you used to see ranting on social media sounds like whining.
Yeah. Especially as an artist.
As an artist because... you're like, everyone looks at you as being privileged already. So then you're like, you know, DJ problems.
Right.
You know, there's a Twitter called DJ problems.
No, I know exactly the one you're talking about. I mean, you know, basically what you're saying is right. There's people to have no sympathy for an someone having an artist career. You
right.
know what I mean? They're not trying to hear you, you know,
right.
complain about anything.
My
you know?
Fly was delayed.
Yeah, my fly's delayed. What's up with this business class seat? You know what I mean? Not reclining 180 degrees. You know, I mean, it's just.
I do get pissed at the airlines, though, I gotta say. Like,
well, sure. But you know what I'm saying. But
yeah, no, I understand. Ridiculous. Whatever. We don't need to complain about the airlines. So I was reading some interviews with you, and you were saying most artists have one really good idea. And like really good artists have a few and are able to present them. Like talk about that a little bit, because I think that's an interesting point of view.
Well, I mean, specifically with that, usually what I meant by that is usually their first album.
Mm-hmm.
And just the idea that, you know, you kind of have your entire life to make your first album.
Right, right.
You know, so your whole... everything that can go into that first one, and then you got like 18 months to make your second one,
right
you know what I mean, and
right
or less to make the third one.
You have all this life experience that leads into that first album where you're like, I'm putting everything into it, and it shows.
And that's usually what gets people's attention.
Yeah, right.
To where it can turn to a thing.
I mean, in a way, you can do that on one album and have an entire career. And you might never touch the shine of that first album, you know, but people will still love you and love your music. And
I mean, exactly. And I think that, I mean, there's more than a few examples of that, right? I mean, and especially in independent music,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's a little different. I think with indie music, there's definitely like a sustainability question, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Where if you're a major label artist, with the scale they're operating at and the kind of other revenue streams they have access to, can make it so that, you know, albums, they can do two or three or maybe four albums and have it, you know, they can live off of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Versus an indie world, you kind of have to have like a, you know, pretty sizable.
It's not about having a big hit that just carries on for the indie world. It's about having a catalog.
Yeah, and consistently doing it. Because, you know, most record sales, you know, on your average, you know, digital title, I want to say, you know, if you looked at the first, you know, 3 years of revenue, I would say 90% of it happens probably the first 6 months.
Uh-huh.
You know, for a new release,
right.
on average.
Right.
You know, usually the first 2 months is really the bulk of it, and then we see it dip, and then it'll flatline at whatever level it stays at.
Uh-huh.
That's just market conditions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that has nothing to do with anything other than, you know, I mean, some of our most critically acclaimed records, okay, records that we've had Pitchfork do rising features on and mm-hmm. multiple premieres and
mm-hmm.
all this crazy stuff, you know, a year later, these are albums, okay, that are making less than $10 a month.
Right. What do you think of Pitchfork?
I mean, I love Pitchfork.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, is... For the most part, I agree with most of their
uh-huh.
reviews. Of course, yeah. I'll take their things personally. If it's a record I'm involved with, they didn't yeah. like, you know, I'll be like,
sure.
Oh, they didn't get it.
They don't get it.
But, you know, I want to say they're pretty on point. If they weren't, they wouldn't be in the position they're in.
Right.
You know?
I think they have interesting picks a lot of the time. It's shit that I've never heard of. Like, definitely they're pulling from this bag a lot of the time that I'm like, this isn't even on my radar.
Yeah, I mean, but one thing's for sure. I mean, Pitchfork does not sell records. Yeah,
right,
that's
exactly,
for sure. And that's a big disconnect.
Ad space.
Well, I mean, it's funny, man. Like sometimes when we get a record featured on there, it almost be like Kiss of Death.
You really? Know?
Like it's weird how that can work, but it's just
there's like a backlash or something.
Yeah, I don't know. It definitely does not result in direct sales. That's for sure.
Do you think that's maybe your audience is not the Pitchfork audience, or necessarily, or something like that? Like,
yeah, I think that. As influential as they are,
mm-hmm.
I think they're more influential in a true, just very, I don't know, not a too direct way. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? It's just kind of like fodder versus mm-hmm. what people really act upon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, you know, for instance, when we're setting up records for marketing, you know, and this is after even talking with folks at iTunes, you know, we talk about it sometimes. They've asked me before, do you think Pitchfork sells you guys sell more records when you get featured on Pitchfork.
Right.
My answer is no. And then they say back is, yeah, we don't think so either.
Right. Oh, interesting.
I mean, and then, of course, that begs the question when I'm asking, like, well, what does matter?
Right.
Okay, if that doesn't matter.
What does matter?
Yeah, what is the...
Well, that's the question I've been asking myself for, like, since the music industry totally changed. What does matter when I look at Facebook and I look at people coming up and I'm like, what is it about this that is appealing? And
well, their answer to me was NPR, you know?
NPR, really?
NPR. They said that if there's any, you know, outlet that you could debut something on that would have, you know, the most impact on digital retail sales, it would be an NPR maneuver, yeah.
Huh.
Which, you know, and we've done that plenty, too.
Most unexpected place that you'd be selling records, right?
Well, what's interesting about it, I think it just has to do
with... Like send Guns N' Roses to NPR for your new album.
Well, I think it has to do
with
the demographic of the people who listen to NPR.
Exactly.
And that these are people who are willing to spend money on records digitally.
Right.
You know, they're digital consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's who we want to be talking to,
mm-hmm. you know,
the most. I mean, ultimately, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the thing about NPR is, I mean, dude, we pitch NPR all the time. Okay, we're lucky to get one thing a year.
Right.
Okay, and that's like sometimes we not even have a year where we don't get anything. You know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? But
mm-hmm.
they are not the easiest nut to crack.
Yeah.
You know,
I think they have their taste. Also, is just you know they pick a variety of stuff that's way off my radar sometimes. I don't listen to it as much as I used to, but when I did, yeah, it was like, you know, I don't know, like they have like some steel drum artist from, from like, Haiti or something. And it's just like, oh, I never heard of this guy. So how did you transition from Concrete Jungle, like drum and bass to hip hop and to like the beat scene?
Well, you know, I mean, even before Concrete, you know, all my production stuff I was doing at the time was underground rap stuff.
You weren't producing drum and bass at all.
I wasn't really. I mean, there was a few things I had done with Hive
uh-huh.
that had kind of seen the light of day, but for the most part, it was just very as you would expect it to be underground rap stuff. You know,
it was like you in your room making beats, and then people would come over and rap into the mic, basically.
Pretty much, and that included you know most notably maybe AWOL One
right.
that era, and then you know Freestyle Fellowship and Abrude, and basically a bunch of the Project.
What
Blow
was your
guys.
What was your studio back then?
I called it back then it was the auditorium.
Like, did you have like an MPC? Is that what you were rocking?
Yeah, I was MPC 2000.
Yeah.
And I had a ADAT, and I had like a 24 channel Mackie mixer, and a DAT, you know, and a few outboard pieces, you know, a few reverb things. And, you know, then me and Hive, we lived together. So he had a more beefed out setup.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the bonuses of living with him is I got to use his stuff, right?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden I'm using like a nice mic and then you know an Eve Pre, and all of a sudden you
totally.
Know things are really good. But
using someone's studio is always like how you I always get started. It's the same thing for me. It's just a magical thing actually. You get to play in this like you're like none of this is mine, but I can use it all.
Totally. I mean well back then too man dude the cost of entry into recording
yeah.
It's insane.
Right.
I mean, I feel like I almost had to like rob a liquor store just to get the MPC, you know, handled. It was much less, you know, all this other recording stuff.
How do you think the lack of that buffer zone has like affected, you know, what people like? Do you think it's affected the quality and that you don't have to like invest $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000 to like be able to do that stuff?
I think that there's like the double-edged sword of it, right? It's like, okay, now anybody can do it, which is great, okay?
Right?
I mean, just on that, just that basis alone. I mean,
sure.
Arguably, there's more beats being made today than any day previously in history.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's awesome. I want a shirt that says that. That's so cool.
But just the same, I mean. It also means you got a bunch of people making music that probably have no business making music, you know,
who would have gotten away from it if it wasn't, you know, if it wasn't so easy to just sit there like, oh, I can do that.
Well, I mean, it's just signal to noise ratio, right? It's just
sure,
like,
right. Exactly. It's just a percentage.
Yeah. And it's just, and not to say that, hey, you know, I mean, it's all good. I don't mean to be discouraging. I'm just saying like, you know, for it, because I love just the therapeutic part of making beats and just the meditative part of it. And, you know, what that can bring to somebody aside from trying to pursue it as a career. I mean, it's just, that's really what it is about, the art side of, you know, the pure art part of it. But what I'm talking about is more of a metaphor for the people who try to pursue it with the wrong intentions. You know what I mean?
Right.
Their attraction to music is not for art's sake. It's, it's for image sake or for financial sake or for some other weird reason that has nothing to do with the art, you know?
How do you deal with that? Like, I mean, you're just, it seems like Alpha Pup has always just stood its ground on, like, you kind of staked your claim and you haven't left, you know, whether like through hell and high water sort of, because there was a long time when Alpha Pup wasn't, and Low End Theory weren't, you know, no one ever heard of it, you know? And
I mean,
were you just like, was Alpha Pup first before Low End Theory?
Yeah. Alpha Pup was, we started it technically in 2004, my wife and I, and then it was 2006 when Low End Theory started. So it was about 2 years, you know what I mean? I'm really about a year and change of actual full operation. But part of Low End Theory for me is, I mean, at the time, you know, we had all these acts on Alpha Pup, and I wanted to have a place for them to perform, and just the idea of having a regular showcase to be able to do that and have that, you know, as a as an option, that was definitely part of my initial conception, you know, of how it could work.
Do you think of Low End as like the CBGBs of sort of the beat scene? Like, that's how I think of it.
I mean, you know, I try to...
It's like a dirty little room where like super magic has happened, and it's like you walk there and you're like, oh, this is nothing special. This is like a fucking hole in the wall.
But I mean, I tell you, brother, I mean, I can't tell you how many people from overseas, when they play the club the first time,
they're surprised.
Dude, they're there at sound check, right, with all the lights on, and they look around. And they
who
almost
did
all,
that? Who?
I can't. I don't. I shouldn't call out names, but it's so many. At least 10 times this has happened where I see the look, and they go, "Dang!" They're like, "This place is small."
Totally.
It's like, yeah, this place is small,
right?
But you know, I mean, to answer your question though, I mean, I'm pretty biased about the whole thing. You know, I'm in the center of that storm. You know, I try to, I think these days more than ever, let, you know, people want to make comparisons like that, or, you know,
you're too in the midst of it.
It's hard for me to think of, I don't think of it that way exactly, but I think that just the idea that there could be this venue that could be a focal point and operate with a regularity that's a small scale, again, small venue.
When you got when you guys got Tom York there, like, how did that happen? Did he text you, or does like his management text you, or like
that was a Fly Low hookup. He had already been, Cosmogramma had already come out, so that song with him on Fly Low's record had already come out, and
he connected you. Was it a surprise to you that night that he was going to show up?
No, it was in the that was in the works for a week prior, and basically I got a text from Fly Low Thursday before, like, yo, Tom York wants to play the club next week. And I wrote, I think I have even said something really weird back, like,
like, you've thought,
whatever, dude, stop playing, or, you know, like, like, is that supposed, I don't know if you're just trying to be funny or something, but, you know,
right,
like basically dismissed it, you know what I mean? And he wrote back, like, no, for real, like, you know, he actually, this might happen. And that was like a, so we knew, so it was funny, the day before, Fly Low wrote on his personal Facebook, he wrote in all caps, tomorrow, but he spelled it T-H-O-M, Tom Morrow, dot, you know, exclamation point, exclamation point. And that was basically when it leaked.
Right?
When it was like all these comments, like, what? You know, like, it's just,
right,
it was obvious. So that's when we get down, there's a line around the block. I mean, we get there at 7, and the line is just, it's like 1,000 people outside already.
Right.
And that's, I want to say at that point, dude, it had already, that day had been teetering, you know, it might happen.
Oh, really?
It might not happen.
Right.
Dude, at 5 o'clock, it was like, it's not happening.
Oh, really?
So,
You're just getting messages from someone on high. You're not actually talking to Tom York.
I'm talking to Flying Lotus about it.
Oh, okay.
He's the bag man on this.
Yeah.
And he's basically texting me, like, saying, like, dude, I don't think it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I get down there. I'm still texting Fly, like, yo, dude, there's a lot of people down here, dude. Like,
yeah. You posted it on Facebook.
Yeah, dude, right? Yeah. Like, he's like, I'm going to come down there. Right, it's like 9:30,
mm-hmm.
and it's still like.
So you guys already started.
We start. I think at that night we started at 10.
Yeah.
First thing James says is, "All right, you guys, we all know, you know, you guys think something's gonna happen tonight with Tom York. Guess what? It's not happening." Right, dude. No joke, dude. Basically, the entire room cleared out.
Really?
Like, people just bounced.
Right. No way.
The line just right. pretty much broke up. Right.
This is brilliant. It's almost like the best way to do it.
So then, but before that happened, Fly Low went out there, took a picture of the line.
Yeah.
And emailed it to him.
Mm.
He didn't even text it to him. This is like even before the expectation that I think
yeah.
he would even have a phone out here on to,
right.
to get a text or yeah. it would even work, you know?
Yeah.
And he wrote back at like, I want to say it was like 11 o'clock. And he wrote back. He showed it to me. He was like, dude, look. And I said, and all it said was, fuck it, I'm coming.
Nice.
So that's when we knew he was coming. And that's when it was like, it was such a.
Did you re-announce it or did you keep it under wraps?
We didn't say anything, Doc. At
yeah,
that point,
of course.
It was like.
Yeah, that's the way to do it for yeah. sure.
And then when he played again, we didn't say anything.
Right.
You know, again, we were
oh, he's
like,
played twice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I saw a video of him playing. It's funny. He looks like he's having way more fun, like as far as just body language. Than when I've seen him play with Radiohead. Like, he was just having, like, a blast in this video I saw of him playing at Low End, just dancing around and just freestyling vocals. And
right.
Just, like, all over the map with it. And, like, just, it was, like, him in his room or something.
They had an interview with Rolling Stone last year.
Mm-hmm.
Where they interviewed, did you see this thing at all, that where they totally diss EDM culture, basically?
No, I didn't see that.
It was, like, him and Nigel Godrich just kind of just, calling fools out,
oh,
basically.
Right, right.
And then they get to the part in the interview and they're like, but there's this other thing going on called Low End Theory. That's pretty much the only shit we like.
That's awesome.
And then they go off about it. Tom York says some crazy, like, yeah, that's pretty much the most exciting gig I've done in years.
Wow.
You know,
that's
since
awesome.
Then. And we're like thinking, like, whoa, dude, like, I don't know. I mean, to us, you know, again, we're so close to it. It's,
yeah.
A trip that we would have a lasting impression because they did that interview years after
right.
the gig.
Oh, right, right, right.
And they're still talking about it.
Yeah, totally.
You know, like the most exciting thing they'd done, which is trippy, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, you guys have had Tom York, Erykah Badu. You're having Africa Bambaataa. That's amazing.
I mean, that's going to be one of the top five bookings I'll ever do.
Yeah.
You know, career.
How did that one happen?
They hit us up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Awesome.
It was by a lady, Ruza Blue, Lady Blue,
mm-hmm.
who's old school New York music person, and she started the Roxy in
oh,
the 80s.
Cool.
New York. I mean, like, she manages both Africa Bambaataa and Grandmaster Flash and has since then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so she's been with them the whole ride.
Wow.
And that was incoming. You know?
Oh, wow.
Talk about amazing. Dude.
I know. That's so cool.
Yeah.
That's so cool. So he's sort of like, it's like grandpa or something.
Yeah. It's amazing.
That's so cool. You know, you've always had that super savvy as far as the music business goes. You know, you're the opposite of that guy who's like got swagger and like wants to meet people and like, you know, be in the music industry. You're like, all business.
Pretty much, dude. I mean,
which
yeah.
I've always admired about you.
I mean, I don't like, I'm not here for the
the party favors. For,
yeah, yeah,
and,
dude. I don't
the free
care.
Free drinks and stuff.
Yeah, and I don't, and honestly, man, I mean, I don't, I'm not like a good schmoozer.
Right.
You know what I mean? I can talk about music, real
right.
music. Like the people I have the best conversations with are other, they're generally other producers. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, we can talk like real music stuff. Mm-hmm. But you know, the music business side of it, like, you know, a majority of agents and managers, I mean, you know, granted there's a few angels out there, you know what I mean? Among the demons, but for the, but for the most part, it's a, you know, that's not, those aren't the folks I'm trying to like, you know, have a relationship with.
You think that's kept you in the game? That's what's kept you in the game for this long, is that you're able to navigate that? You're a good read. You're a good read of people.
I try to. I mean, I've just tried to get to the point where I'm just not, like, in a way, people, I mean, still to this day, man, you'd be amazed, you know, when people try to run game on me, especially a low end.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I remember this story you told me. I think it was about Megazoid. Megazoid's manager. This is another one of my favorite Daddy Kev stories. And Megazoid's manager, they wanted Megazoid to play the club. And you're like, cool, it's $500. That's just like the standard deal we give everyone. And they were like, well, we're getting paid $5,000, you know, or we can't take anything less than that. And you were like, you responded, let me make this easy for you. No.
Yeah, man. I mean, you'd be surprised,
like,
too.
Managers, I mean, and agents trying, like, hitting you up about low end and, like,
well, you know,
being like, you have to have this there, or they need to be picked up like this, or that kind of stuff.
Or, well, I mean, dude, you'd be amazed how these negotiations go sometimes. I mean, I'll have an agent be like, all right, so we got so and so coming to LA. We're thinking, you know, $5,000.
Right.
Right. And then my email response will be, cool, you know, the date sounds great. We're thinking like 200. Right?
Yeah. Like, but then, no, you never even acknowledge the difference.
No, and then the response comes back, how about 300?
Oh, right. That's awesome. That's amazing.
And it's...
Does that just blow open the door on, like, this, the music industry in some ways, when you realize that, like, everyone's coming at you saying this number, and you say, here's what's real, and people adapt?
They know.
Right, they know.
You know, and it's just, I mean, we pay, I mean, the thing is, number one, at low end, we have a very fixed budget, you know what I mean? That's something that a lot of people don't realize, is the majority of the people in that club either A, pay the $5 discounted cover, because there's like thousands of those cards out there, our membership cards, or B, got them for free.
Yeah.
Right? Our guest list is like, it's a terror, I mean, it's insane how large it is, even though we've tried to cut it down.
Yeah.
It's still just, you know, a huge hemorrhage for us. You know, it really, there's just not a lot of money to go around.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and that's how we know,
I
too.
I think that's part of what makes it real, though. You know what I mean? I think if you guys were worrying about money, it would take away from what low end is, because it's not, no, because when you're there and you're playing and it's not about the money, your attitude about the gig is different. I've had that feeling when I play for the Dolab at Coachella, everyone's playing for free.
Right.
And when you want to, when you basically paid to be there, like, that's the kind of gig that you obviously are going to put some care into. Otherwise, why the hell take it?
Totally. I mean, and, you know, but I really just try to stay focused on what, on, especially more than ever, on just the fundamentals, you know what I mean? And getting about what my day-to-day fundamentals need to be, things that, you know, just need to pushing the whole thing forward. And for me, like, I don't really go out anymore. I mean, again, I've been in this game for a long time. I've been on active duty in the LA Underground since 92, you know? So I got 20...
active duty, dude.
So I've got 22 years, you know,
right,
deep in
and
here.
And now you have two kids.
Yeah, man.
You're married, you're like...
Yeah, and I got like a gang of homies, and, you know, like, I'm just not trying to be out there social butterfly style.
Do you ever walk into the club and you're kind of like, it's like walking into your elementary school classroom or
something?
All
the time. I mean, well, dude, I mean, you know, Frank, you know, we grew up together, right?
I know, I didn't know that. That's crazy.
So it's just like,
you and him are just like, we're doing it again.
Yeah, pretty
much. Time to make the donuts.
Pretty much.
That's awesome. Who your dream, like, who is on your list that you would love to get for low end?
Aphex Twin.
That would be awesome.
Boards of Canada.
Do you ever inquire, or you just...
I've inquired.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, those are off the table as far as I'm concerned. As far as I know.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, if there's going to be a U.S. tour, I would like to think we...
With Aphex, yeah.
We'd know about it just because of how close I am with the Warp folks at this point. But I don't think... I've asked them. I've been asking them.
So, okay, you've been asking them. Who else?
I really want to get Oizo.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to think of just some folks that... Jose James would be awesome.
Uh-huh.
I'm just trying to think of folks that are actually might.
That might actually. No, I'm talking about ones that might.
Like,
that
would never happen?
No, I'm just talking about, like, yeah, like Dream List.
Dre.
Right.
Snoop. Mobb Deep.
Uh-huh.
Premier.
Yeah. I mean, that almost happened, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a time when I was talking to Premier about Alpha Pup.
Right. You know? Yeah.
And that was one of the most heartbreaking, you know, experiences in the music business.
Right.
For me, being so close.
Right.
And basically a signed deal and have the whole thing unravel.
Right.
Yeah, that's
so weird about this business. Like, until, like, it's in your hand, the money's in your hand, nothing is, it can all just evaporate in a heartbeat. And it's funny when I see people celebrating those small gains where you're like, you got, like, picked for the tour, but, like, anything could happen from then on, you know, like.
You'd be kicked off the tour.
You get kicked off the tour. You, like, have a tour shit time slot. Yeah. Tour gets canceled, like. You don't get along with all the people on the tour and they fucking hate you and, you know, you have a terrible time. I mean, like, it's all kinds of, it's funny with the business that, like, I've learned over years and years of, like, kind of getting knocked down is to keep an even keel, you know, to, like, just when good things happen, I'm super grateful and I'm always happy to be here. That's one thing I always remind myself, you know, I'm just happy to be still in the game.
Oh, yeah. I mean, dude,
every day.
Dude, me too, man. I mean, it's, you can't take it for granted, you
exactly.
know, because it's just a really, you know, it's a very tough business, man. It's straight up. And there's a lot of people who look at it as a zero-sum game.
Right.
You know, they're only going to advance if you go
down. Right,
you know what I mean? And that becomes their attitude towards other artists. And you know, I mean, it definitely, from my observation, that's not how the business works. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
We don't get to no one person gets to sway can actually make people get money out of their pocket and pay for stuff.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's a decision the audience makes, and we just have to be realistic about that and what we can actually affect and what we can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just trying to do our best, of course, to, you know, provide discovery mechanisms for people to try to figure it out on their own. But you know, it's definitely. I think it's important just to keep a, you know, level head about the whole thing.
Yeah, right? yeah, definitely. I feel like that's what you've shown and, like, teach by example with, like, you know, a lot of the people that come up, artists you've worked with, you know.
Well, I just try to be to the point, man, you know.
And I remember you also said to me once, if you ever get a check from a record that's, like, 0.00 cents, there's something
problem.
Wrong.
Yeah.
I love that. That's really good advice, actually, and something most people might not think about, but.
Well, dude, yeah. I mean.
It means they said, oh, well, let's just pay him this much.
I mean, Crowdy, you'd be amazed. I'm still amazed at how accounting can go today.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And, you know, especially some of these emerging labels, and, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, unless you have, like, an accounting background
mm-hmm.
or someone on the team,
yeah.
right? Because we're talking about, you know, I mean, you see the reports we generate for you, right?
Yeah.
We're talking about thousands.
They're the best reports that, are, you know, I've heard bigger bands don't get those reports from Sony and things like that.
Yeah, and we try to do it the best, like industry best.
Yeah.
That said, that's a lot of data.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, luckily we have systems, custom systems to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're just coming into this and you're like, all right, okay, I'm going to reconcile 20,000 line items of data right now
mm-hmm.
for 10 artists.
Right.
You can try to do that by hand.
Right.
Dude, you can be doing that till next year.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And I think sometimes what people don't realize is just that that's old. You know, this is all fun and games until people aren't getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's when, you know, that's, you know, that's when it all, you know, people aren't friends anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it turns into you use me and, you know, whatever type of feelings people have.
Yeah.
You know, at the same time, you know, I tell a lot of folks, you know, because I've been through it myself,
mm-hmm.
you know, and witnessed it. And it's a very, how should I put it, man? You know, people got to have realistic expectations.
Yeah.
You know, if like your childhood best friend starts a record label and has no experience in accounting, how in the world are you going to expect this dude to actually account
uh-huh.
on any sort of regular basis
uh-huh.
if they just don't have the skill set?
Uh-huh.
And I don't know. You know what I mean? I've been on both sides of this, and you know.
Yeah.
And,
totally.
And even.
The business is always a tough thing.
It is.
All right. Let me do a couple more things.
Sure.
And we'll let you go.
Sure.
I wanted to throw out some names for Low in Theory, like as if these people's management or something text you and said, this person's in town. They want to play Low in Theory. I want you to tell me whether you would yes or no.
Okay.
Diplo.
Maybe. I mean, you know, we were trying to get him for our festival.
Oh, okay.
But there's been a sea change with me and Elvin talking about the kind of above ground stuff we'd want to go for.
Yeah, that's what I'm curious about, like, and where that line is for you guys.
Yeah, so, you know, I want to say Diplo, yeah.
Skrillex?
I want to say yeah, yeah. Those are not easy yeahs, sorry.
No problem. This one's an easy one. Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, two seconds.
Miley Cyrus.
No.
Excision.
No.
Juicy J.
Yes.
One Direction.
No.
Prince.
Yes.
Good answer.
I'll tell you, I don't know if you've ever heard the story of when Prince came to Low in Theory.
Oh, really? No, I didn't hear that.
It sounds better when I just say that and end it.
We just leave it there.
This is during like the dark era of the summer of 2007 when we left the airliner for 2 months and tried to do this at other clubs. So we went to Echoplex for a few weeks. We're dying over there. They booted us. Then we went to Little Temple. And that's when it was late, man. I'm talking like 1:15 in the morning. Club is dead. Okay, there's like 10 people up in there. And he had performed there before, Prince.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, we're thinking the night's pretty much over. And what do you know? Up comes this limo. Bodyguard comes up, and he talks to the security, and he asks him, he's like, hey, you know, we got Prince in the car. Is it cool if he uses the bathroom?
Really? No way.
So in they... I see him, then walk the purple one in to the
awesome.
Bathroom.
That's amazing.
And he came out. He sat at the bar for a second, maybe a minute, and then left.
Well, yeah,
that was the night Prince came to Low in Theory.
That's perfect.
Trippy thing, though, yeah. And we had, you know, Heath Ledger came to Low in Theory before he passed.
I didn't know that.
That was also another... We've had a bunch of odd, you know, Vanessa Hudgens.
Okay.
She was there recently.
Well, who was at the Low in Theory Festival that was just getting...
LaBeouf?
Yeah. Yeah. LaBeouf, dude. He's just tearing it up. There's this awesome photo of you talking to him that Maddie took that is just like, you're kind of like, you can't do this sort of look, like, with your hands and everything. It's
dude,
so
the
funny.
The funniest part of that night, you know, he was bugging during John Wayne's set.
Yeah.
You know, he was side stage rapping
right.
to himself.
Yeah.
Right. And just acting like a maniac.
Yeah.
Okay. And then John Wayne gets off stage and he's like, he walks up. He's like, you're a genius, man. You're a fucking genius. You know, like LaBeouf is saying this to him and Wayne just kind of like, yeah. He keeps saying it. Like, keeps saying it.
Right.
To the point where it's uncomfortable. Wayne ends up leaving.
Right.
And it's just me and him left. He's like, yeah, man, it was fucking awesome, right? And I'm like, yeah, dude, it was dope, man, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he kept saying, and then he's like, yeah, man, I fucking loved Shlomo. I was like, oh. Okay.
That's amazing.
Anyway, yeah.
That's cool. All right, I'm gonna let you go because we talked for a while.
All
that
good,
was awesome.
Man. Hopefully there's some good stuff in there, you know.
I think there's some great stuff in there. I learned a lot, actually. And yeah, dude, you've been holding it down.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah, dude.
I look forward to it going online.
Definitely.
Cool.
I'll let you know when it does.
Thanks for listening.
All right. Thanks, everybody. This is Crowdy signing off.